I'm John Krall. Guns and gun laws are among the most hotly debated issues in American life these days. President Obama's executive action announced earlier this week, and a handful of bills introduced at the same time in the Indiana legislature that would loosen state gun laws, have only added to the controversy. Today on No Limits, we're going to try to cut through the noise surrounding the debate on guns. My guests are Indiana Representative Jim Lucas, a Republican from Seymour and author of some of the bills in question, former state representative and constitutional scholar David Orentlicker, and Stephanie Mannon-Grabo of Moms Demand Action Indiana. Join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or finding us on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about guns, gun laws, and gun policies. And if you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are State Representative Jim Lucas, Republican from Seymour, Stephanie Mannon-Grabo, who is with Moms Demand Action Indiana, and former Indiana State Representative, where he's a Democrat from Indianapolis, Professor of Constitutional Law and current candidate for U.S. Congress, David Orentlicker. Welcome, all of you, to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's good to have you all here. And I'm going to start here. I can tell already I've got a stack of emails, people who want to ask questions and participate. So I'm going to lay down a few ground rules here because I know this is one of those subjects that people on all sides of the question have really strong feelings about. One of them is everybody's going to have a chance to be heard. Okay, so if there's a point you disagree with, we're going to find a way to give you a chance to make your disagreement clear. And that goes to the audience as well as the panelists. We're also going to be, I hope it goes without saying, civil and respectful with each other. This is a forum in which we try to generate more light than heat, and we're going to adhere to that. So I'm going to start first. We obviously have Representative Lucas in here, who is the author of some of the bills. We're going to talk about those. But what kind of kicked this into overdrive at the national level was the president's executive action earlier this week. And, you know, I'm going to ask our constitutional law scholar to start off by explaining exactly what the president did in terms of public policy and constitutional procedure. Representative Orentlicker.
Well, thank you.
Certainly.
So the president's actions in terms of is there any constitutional problem with what he did? And the answer is almost certainly not. The kinds of constitutional challenges you can raise are the Second Amendment. Government has no business limiting our rights. That's one argument. There's also an argument of what's called the federalism argument. This is a kind of regulation that states should be imposing. If there's going to be a regulation, not the federal government. The federal government is a government of limited powers. This belongs to the states. And we had a case in the 1990s about that, a law preventing people from possessing guns near schools, and the court struck that down because that's within the state's authority, not the federal authority. And then the third would be the national government can do this, but Congress should be doing it, not the president. Where is the Congress is supposed to be setting policy? How does the president have authority to do this? Now, that would be the most likely challenge, but the president was very careful in what he did. For example, he didn't issue an executive order which would be binding. He, for some of the provisions, for example, who counts as a gun seller and has to do a background check, he issued effectively a guidance. There's a statute out there that distinguishes between covered sellers who have to get a license and non-people who just sell occasionally, have the collectors of guns, and they occasionally sell a gun. They don't have to conduct background checks. So this law has to be enforced. And what the president issued was a guidance to say, as you're interpreting this statute, here are some principles that you can distinguish between the, you know, the person who's in the business of selling guns and has to have a license and has to do background checks, and the person who is just a collector and occasionally sells a gun and is not in the business of selling guns and doesn't have to sell a license. That kind of a guidance that doesn't require, is not subject, susceptible to constitutional challenge, only if it were implemented in a way that they were really changing the rules. And then the challengers could come, and this would be more of an administrative law argument. Before you change the rules, you've got to go through process, give people a chance to comment and raise objections. But as he's done it, he's also asked for more money to fund more agents to enforce the laws, to make sure that the laws we have on the books are properly enforced. He's asked for more money, and that's, you know, the ball's in Congress's court to authorize the money. So looking at what he's done on his face, it's hard to see anything that a court challenge would be successful. You'd have to see that they, you know, when they carry things out, they do it in a way that's different from what the president said.
Representative Lucas, did you agree with or disagree? Well, do you agree or disagree with that analysis, constitutional law, and then we'll get into the policy implications of it, whether you agree or disagree with those?
Well, who am I to argue with somebody, a constitutional scholar, but when you look at the meat and potatoes of what the president did, essentially he did nothing but solidify both sides of this issue, in my opinion. He's going after what they call the gun show loophole, which I still have no idea what that is. I know that's being bandied about quite a bit by the gun control side of this issue. But the Department of Justice has shown that less than 2% of criminals actually get their firearms from gun shows. Now, as far as extending the definition of who can and who can't sell firearms, I know the Internet sales has been brought up as an issue. But whenever you purchase a firearm on the Internet, you have to have that sent to an FFL dealer. So, again, I don't see any big progress made on that front.
So, in some ways, don't worry, Stephanie, I will give you a chance to jump in on this too. Everyone's going to get a chance to talk. In some ways, what I'm hearing is you're not that concerned one way or the other, which about the executive action, which sort of mirrors what at least one of the National Rifle Association spokespeople said. You know, this is it. This is all, because it really, they didn't think it was going to affect the issue one way or the other all that much. Is that your read on it?
Oh, no, it's always a concern when people start infringing or talking about infringing further our gun rights. For any of this to work, ultimately, you have to register the firearms, which many of us on the gun rights side of this issue see as the ultimate goal, is leading to registration. We've already seen several states attempt that right now. But, you know, on a national scale, this is something that we always have to be aware of.
Stephanie, this is your point to jump in. I know you.
Yeah, well, let me start by saying that Moms Demand Action is definitely a pro-Second Amendment organization. We respect the Second Amendment. Our organization is made up of gun owners and non-gun owners. We are nonpartisan. We have Republicans and Democrats and rural and urban. We are the cross-section of America. But what we know we can do is respect the Second Amendment and keep our families and our communities safer. What the president did on Tuesday was what the gun lobby has been asking for forever, which is the gun lobby has been asking forever, saying just enforce the laws that are on the books. And what the president did was give our law enforcement officials the tools to be able to enforce those laws. He's asked for more ATF agents. He's asked for strengthening the NICS system, which is the background check system. He's asking states to make sure that they are reporting seriously mentally ill individuals into the system to prohibit those people from getting guns. So it did not close the gun show loophole, but what it did was narrow the loophole that exists for private sellers.
I'm going to take a question now, an email question from a regular listener of ours named Jerry that I think sort of frames what we're trying to get at here. I'm going to read the whole thing. Jerry says, and I should say to our listeners, if you want to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Jerry says, I have spent hundreds of hours within the past year discussing various aspects of gun control with my neighbors in Irvington. I grew up in a Hoosier family with strong rural connections. Varmint hunting and shooting birds and animals for food were not controversial issues. I own a rifle and a shotgun, which, although I have fired neither since sometime in the last century, I have tried to keep in working order. What most forcibly strikes me about my efforts to find common ground with my neighbors is the apparent intractability of opinions on the subject. I have floated a number of ideas which make sense to me, ranging from simple limitations on the size of ammunition magazines, 10 rounds is enough, he says in parentheses, to requiring liability insurance for firearms. None has so far been taken very seriously by my fellow citizens. I have met heated disagreement even over such basic notions that perhaps there could be somewhat different rules for handguns versus long guns or for rural versus urban environments. I end up in extended and largely uninformed arguments about the real meaning of the Second Amendment. My question for today's panel, what must we do to get everybody rationally engaged in practical discussion of these important issues? Stephanie, since you had the last word last time, I'm going to give you the first word this time.
I think we're there. I mean, to Jerry, I would say I grew up in a gun-owning family in the rural South, shooting at varmints as well. We are there. The conversation has changed, and we are now having substantive conversation, and action is being taken across the country. Since Newtown, we've had 6 new states enact background check legislation, and we know that background checks for all gun sales are the single biggest step we can take to keep our community safe. So I actually think we're there having the conversation right now. That's why we're here today.
And I guess the part of this, and I'm going to redirect this to Representative Lucas right now, I think that Jerry is, are there any points, though, of common ground where we can all agree? Because that, I think, is the spirit of his question, is that, you know, a conversation on this subject inevitably seems to end up in an argument in which people aren't listening to each other. Is there any area of common ground, Representative Lucas?
Great question. I'm not sure really if there is, because we have to look at one of the major issues of this is because there is so much emotion that's brought into it. And what I see, my years spent studying this and being a pro-gun legislator and somebody that tries to get out in the forefront of this, is there's so much misinformation and distortion of the actual facts. And with all due respect, Stephanie, when we're talking about background checks, over 90% of the recent mass shooters have passed background checks. You know, when we look at the Fort Hood shooters and the Navy Yard shooter, I believe in 2013, they passed extensive background checks. And still, they went about their business of murdering innocent, defenseless people, made defenseless by current gun laws. And I know the recent shooting out in California, at the San Bernardino, not only did they were able to acquire their firearms through illegal means, but they passed several vetting processes from the federal government to get over here and do their thing. So I posed this question several times in the past, and I'll continue to pose it. As a current lawmaker, what law would somebody bring me that I can propose that will work on people that have absolutely no regard for human life or law? And we have to keep in mind that the people that are committing these crimes are already breaking a multitude of existing laws and many federal felonies as well. And to sit there and think that more laws are just going to keep us safe, I think, are counterproductive and actually cause more harm than good because they can provide a false sense of security. So I think it's time to reevaluate the laws that we have on the books. Are they being enforced? Are they being adhered to? And we're seeing that that's not happening as well, because I know federal gun prosecutions have decreased significantly in the last several years as along with prosecutions in many of our communities. We're seeing many gun crimes that are or gun charges that are dismissed or pled down, and we're seeing daily in the paper where these felons are out on the street after serving just a portion of their sentence, and you know they have lengthy criminal records, and those are things that I think we need to look at first before we go about implementing new gun laws.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about guns and gun policy, gun laws here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. My guests are Indiana Representative Jim Lucas. He's a Republican from Seymour, former state representative and constitutional law professor David Orentlicker, and Stephanie Manon-Grabo of Moms Demand Action Indiana. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. We are talking about guns and gun legislation here on the show today. My guests are State Representative Jim Lucas, Republican from Seymour, who has authored several gun bills in the state legislature, Stephanie Manon-Grabo of Moms Demand Action Indiana, and David Orentlicker, who's a former Democratic state representative from Indianapolis. He's a professor of constitutional law and a candidate for Congress. If you would like to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ray, welcome to the program.
Hi. I don't own a gun, but I do pack some pepper spray on my T-ring. I consider myself a moderate, like to learn from both sides of the issue. I got a theoretical question. I checked earlier in the week about the top two firearm manufacturers, and one of them gained 100% in the last year, and the others gained 150%. And for a parallel, I was just wondering if we can hold them responsible in some way to, charge them some money. And I was wondering what your panel would say as far as, taking after the tobacco industry where they charge the manufacturers of the cigarettes.
Well, and I thank you very much for the call and the question, Ray. I think that one probably is one we need to direct to the constitutional lawyer on the panel here, Representative Orentlicker.
Yeah, the answer to this is like with most of the questions that raised with the law is most of the obstacles for those kinds of proposals are political rather than constitutional. So, for example, if you look at the decision by the Supreme Court, which recognized the Second Amendment right, they were very clear that a complete ban on handguns in your home violated your interest in self-defense. But they also were very clear that, most of the common rules we have, regulations we have, are fine about limiting possession of firearms by felons or mentally ill persons or carrying firearms in sensitive places such as schools or regulating the sale of firearms. So it's really political obstacles to those kinds of to regulations, not so far, because the Supreme Court has not undoubtedly will have more cases down the line. But right now it's more political, and I'd say the same thing here. Politically, holding tobacco manufacturers liable was popular, and that happened. There's less political support for holding firearms manufacturers liable, and that's what's prevented imposition of liability so far. But there would not be a constitutional problem if the state wanted to hold them liable. What would stop them is there may be federal legislation that would stop them, but Congress certainly could hold them liable too.
Gotten a couple of tweets from a listener named Nikki, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Nikki says, Missouri saw increased gun murders after a bill like House Bill 1056. And asks Representative Lucas how you can justify this in Indiana. And you probably ought to explain what House Bill 1056 proposes to do first, because not everybody has tracked this, and then talk about why you're introducing it, and then we can get to her question.
Thank you, John. House Bill 1056 essentially decriminalizes lawful carry of a Hoosier right now. It has been branded the Constitutional Carry Bill, and it was modeled after our existing gun laws, which when you look at current Indiana licensing gun laws, it is a shall-issue state, no training required, and we have a lifetime license available. Now, shall-issue and no training mean that unless you are prohibited from carrying a firearm, as in if you've been convicted of a felony or domestic abuse, you will get your firearm license. So it makes absolutely no sense to me and to other people that are looking to decrease the size of government why an innocent, lawful citizen of Indiana should have to pay the state, wait several months, jump through hoops to prove their innocence. And my comment to Nikki would be, I would respectfully disagree with those stats because I know stats can be twisted any way a person wants. A prohibited person carrying a firearm is doing so illegally anyway. Licensing is not going to have anything to do with it. So, again, why are we infringing upon the rights of the innocent person and forcing them to react to government law and making them a criminal if they don't go through these actions?
And to be fair to Nikki, she did cite, but I dropped the Johns. She took it from a Johns Hopkins study. Stephanie, you want to say something, I can tell.
I do. I think that it's important that we verify that people are who they say they are. I trust that the representative is a fine, upstanding individual and doesn't abuse his spouse. But I also like to think in terms of Ronald Reagan and trust but verify, and having those permits in place to verify that people truly are upstanding, sane individuals is an important checkpoint when we're talking about dangerous weapons.
And I'm going to throw this one to Representative Orentlicker. I mean, in some ways, what Representative Lucas has presented here or posited is that this is a constitutional right, and it's probably time to introduce into this discussion that frankly, Indiana's constitution goes beyond the U.S. Constitution. There's none of the language in there about militia or well-regulated that has provoked debate for more than 200 years. It pretty much says you have a right to own a gun, period. Does that prove problematic in terms of any sort of gun regulation in this state in particular, Representative Orentlicker?
Well, clearly when you have a constitutional right, it limits the ability of government to regulate. But it's also true that when the state has a very important interest at stake, what the courts will call a compelling state interest, so really important state interest, certainly national security, and protecting public safety and public health are very important state interests. And so when you have that important an interest at stake where the government's coming in saying we're trying to protect other people from harm, then you're allowed to regulate. But when you do regulate, it has to be well-targeted. You can't have a law that reaches everybody, that the representative's concern is, you're trying to target the bad guys. You're also regulating the good guys, the people who aren't causing problems. And what the courts would say, when you have a fundamental right, your law has to be addressed at the people who we're worried about, who are risk for causing harm, not sweeping broadly. So when you do search and seizures, you can't just, it would make the police life easier if they could just go into everybody's home when they're looking for evidence of crime. But we don't allow them to do that because for people who are haven't done anything to arouse suspicion, you can't come and, search our homes and pat us down. You have to have a reason to target us, and the same idea here. So yes, it does put limits on the government. You have to be able to show that this will protect public welfare, and that gets to the studies that we've heard, that has been discussed, the Johns Hopkins study. Can you really show us that if you pass this regulation, it will protect people from harm? It will reduce gun homicides or accidental gun injuries or suicide? And does the law, is it properly targeted in a way that really gets at the problem without sweeping too broadly?
I'm going to, and I should invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Representative Orrin LeGrand, I'm going to stay with you for just a second because that is, you know, there are constitutional protections in place here. Could you explain, though, for example, you could make an argument that texting or sending an email is a protected First Amendment right, but we say you can't do that while you're driving. That, you know, what is the distinction here, or is there no distinction?
Well, that is a good example. You're right. Because often the parallels, people will say, well, the other kinds of liberties you're talking about aren't constitutional rights, and so you have more freedom to regulate drivers and licensing drivers, but there's no constitutional right to drive, whereas the constitutional right to own guns. So you, that's good. It's important to pick, as your analogy, is somebody who's exercising a constitutional right like the, such as the First Amendment right, which is a very fundamental right, and we do are allowed to impose reasonable restrictions to protect public safety. And the same idea would be here. But again, when we're talking about First Amendment, courts are very careful about, are you going too far and infringing too far on the right to speech? So it has to be a limited, targeted kind of rule that says it's really about public safety and doesn't go much beyond that.
We are talking about guns, gun legislation, gun policies here on No Limits. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
My comments are really addressed to the Republican legislator. It seems to me that many of the more conservative people, conservative legislators, are targeting and making it more difficult to vote for people to vote, and making it easier for them to go out and buy guns. And I, as a person who is somewhat concerned about human rights and civil rights, I really would prefer it be a little bit more difficult to buy a gun and a little bit less difficult to vote. You can go out and buy a car. You can drive, but you have to have a license. You can get certain medications. You have to have a prescription. You can buy certain kinds of anti-cold medicines, and you have to register that because the drug makers, or the illegal drug makers, rather, would go out and buy those things in bulk and then turn them into meth. But it does bother me that that many of these legislators are out there making it too easy to carry a gun, and sometimes they're going to say that they can go out and have these guns on campus and carry these guns into a bar or even carry these guns into a grocery store. I don't think that's right.
Okay. John, let me give Representative Lucas a chance to respond. Thank you very much for the call and the question.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for calling in. Good points. But keep in mind that while we're up here fighting for gun rights, that we're also fighting for your rights as well to be able to defend yourself and family against any harm that may come your way. As far as the other issues that you brought up, I don't view those in the same light as a constitutionally protected right, especially with Representative Ortlecker earlier referred to Article 1, Section 32 of the Indiana State Constitution, which is, it's very plain, the people shall have a right to bear arms for defense of themselves in the state. And that's followed up with a period. There are no precautions or anything put on that. And one of the things I would like to mention and bring up and point out that a lot of the things that we overlook in this discussion when it comes to our gun rights is personal responsibility. And we can't forget that a gun is nothing more than a tool. As a matter of fact, according to the FBI, there were more people killed last year with hammers and blunt objects than what there were rifles. So again, it's nothing more than a tool that can be abused or used in a good way. So when we get to discussions like that, when we start comparing them to other things, I merely just my default is back to that it is a constitutionally protected right, and it applies to everybody. And geography, you mentioned some areas where that might be made more safe or unsafe. Those really don't affect, in my mind, the intent of the person that is behind the trigger.
Stephanie.
Well, I would just say he's right. A gun is a tool. It's a very deadly tool. But that's why we're asking for background checks on individuals and not on guns.
We are talking about guns and gun laws, and I think this is something we referred to. This is an email from a listener named Julia, and if you'd like to find us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Julia says, as a way to try to find common ground, I pose this question to Representative Lucas. Indiana is one of the few states that has a law that allows guns to be confiscated from domestic abusers. Given that approximately 9 women are shot and killed each week by domestic abusers, does he support this law and its vigorous enforcement? As well, what would he support? Would he support a law that prosecuted parents that leave their guns unsecured that results in children being killed?
Well, obviously, those are tragedies. To answer the first question, absolutely, I would support a law. Anybody that's been deemed by the courts as being a threat to themselves or others, obviously we have to do something with. We have to keep an eye on them and give them the help that they need, but make sure that they don't pose a threat to themselves or others in the future. But what we have to be careful with those laws is that they aren't, they don't continue indefinitely, that we have a set of standards that we deal specifically with a person before we go taking their rights away or locking them up. I would be very concerned about that. And as far as the other question, holding parents accountable, yes. I mean, to an extent, we have to. Were they negligent? Or which any time a gun is left unsecured or not safely stored, there is a negligence issue. And we're all concerned about that as rational human beings. We don't want to see that happen. But we also have to look into each situation as an individual incident.
Is there a way, and I'll throw this to all three of you here, keeping in mind that we're getting a little bit tight on time, is one of the ways, I mean, some of what we're talking about here are really, you know, criminal laws, criminal penalties. Is there a way maybe to deal with this in a civil law sense and assume that, you know, if you use your car improperly, or you know, in terms of other constitutional rights, you violate certain guidelines and violate the rights of other people, you can be held responsible or liable for that. Is there a way, perhaps, that we could say if you use a gun improperly, you're subject to not leaving it properly secured where somebody else can get to it, you would be held liable for that. Stephanie, I'm going to give you a shot at that one first.
Well, I think that keeping kids safe from unintentional gun violence is probably the place that we all agree. Those cases are clearly negligent. Usually those come down to a prosecutor's discretion as to whether or not to charge a parent with negligence. We know that in the early days of Mothers Against Drunk Driving fight against drunk driving, when a child was killed in a drunk driving accident, often prosecutors would not prosecute the parents, saying that, oh, well, the family has suffered enough because of this terrible tragedy. I think today that has changed. We're not all the way there, but I do think we are seeing more and more prosecutors stepping up to charge families with negligence when a child is hurt or killed in a situation like that.
I'm going to give Representative Lucas and Representative Warnt-Licker a chance to respond to that after we get back from the break. We are talking about guns, gun legislation, and gun policy here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are State Representative Jim Lucas. He's a Republican from Seymour. Stephanie Manning-Grabo, who is with Moms Demand Action Indiana. And former State Representative David Orentlicker, who is also a professor of constitutional law. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about guns, gun legislation, gun policy here on No Limits. My guests are Indiana Representative Jim Lucas, who is a Republican from Seymour and has authored several bills before the Indiana General Assembly regarding guns, Stephanie Mannon Grabo, who is with Moms Demand Action Indiana, and former state representative and professor of constitutional law, David Orentlicker. Representative Orentlicker, I'm going to let you speak to the legal implications of the question I posed about whether there is a way to deal with some of this problem by imposing responsibility through, you know, civil liability. Is that a workable option or not?
Certainly, in terms of could you do that, you know, as a theoretical question, sure, with rights come responsibilities. And when you exercise your rights, you need to do it in a responsible way. And if you're doing it in a way that you're negligent or otherwise careless and it causes harm to others, it's appropriate to hold you responsible. So, again, too, we come back to how politically feasible is it. But in terms of constitutional principles or other principles of law, this is an area of tort law when you hold people responsible for causing harm to others. It's perfectly consistent with general legal principles, and then it's up to the legislatures at the state and federal level to decide whether they want to carry over these important principles in this setting that we do in other settings.
Representative Lucas, I'm going to give you the last word here on this.
Well, thank you.
Certainly.
I think we're all in agreement here on this issue. Obviously, childhood safety and keeping kids safe from firearms is a primary concern to all rational people, even on both sides of the issue that we're talking about here. And Stephanie raised a very good point, which I touched on earlier, as David just mentioned, is personal responsibility, holding people accountable for their actions. But when we're dealing with childhood safety, I would like to take this opportunity right now to publicly reach out to Moms Demand and see if we can't get more firearm safety classes in schools. I know the NRA has an excellent program, Eddie the Eagle, that we can teach, you know, children, hey, don't touch a gun, you know, go get an adult, leave it alone. So I think this is a great opportunity to move forward in making the world a safer place for our children when it comes to the issue of firearms.
Stephanie, how do you feel about that?
Moms Demand Action has a great safety program. It's called Be Smart for Kids, besmartforkids.org. You can go on there and learn about gun safety around children. We have a fundamental belief that a child's safety around a gun is the responsibility of the adults. It is never a child's responsibility to be safe around the gun because the child should never be left in that situation. So just like we put adult caps on our prescription medication, and just like we lock up our poisons out of reach, and we put our sharp knives out of a child's reach, storing our guns locked, unloaded, secured is an adult's responsibility. Yes.
I've gotten a tweet from a listener named Allie who says, I walked into a gun show and bought a rifle, AR-15, without any questions asked. I think there should be some kind of check. Representative Lucas, I mean, should that be possible? Should it be possible to do something like that?
Why not? Is Stephanie a bad person? Is Stephanie going to take that piece of metal and do something bad with it? I mean, what are her intentions?
But if there's no check, how do we know that? I guess would be the next question. I mean, would you feel bad if Charles Manson walked in and bought one?
We can't help what Charles Manson does any more than we can what Stephanie does or anybody else. But again, everybody else, when we look at the vast majority of these mass shooters, they've been checked out. They've passed background checks. They've purchased their firearms legally. You know, again, I want to point out we have to be careful about gun laws giving us a false sense of security, thinking that they're going to be keeping us safe from people that have bad intention.
And I guess I'll throw out then what I think is the overarching question here. I mean, the numbers indicate that we have, as a nation, a much bigger problem with gun violence than any other developed country on the world. Well, why is that? What are other countries doing that we are not? I'll throw that one to Representative Lucas first, but I want to hear from everybody on that, because that seems to me to be the puzzle.
Well, with all due respect, I think those numbers are being fudged, because when you look at the FBI, the number of firearm homicides have actually decreased significantly in the last several years. And there was recently a report out showing that overall gun deaths have gone down by over 50% in the last 20 years. And this is during a time frame where gun sales have absolutely exploded. And if you want to focus on gun deaths, I would highly recommend that we look at, you know, the areas that these homicides are taking place. A lot of them are your inner cities. You know, Chicago, for instance, some of the most strict gun laws in the nation. But yet they have a horrendous firearms problem up there. And then the follow-up answer to that is, well, they're coming down to Indiana and getting their guns because they're so easy to get down here, which I'm going to follow up with. If they're doing that, if they're transporting firearms across state line to commit crime with, they are breaking a multitude of federal laws right now. You know, many held subject to stiff fines and a lot of time in jail. But there again, we're seeing federal gun crimes. The prosecution of those have greatly decreased. So this is one of those things that guns aren't the problem. It's the person that is holding the gun. Because when you look at the amount of firearms that are being purchased right now, and this is a good sign that I see, you've got average American, especially women, that are realizing that they are the first and best line of self-defense. They're going out and purchasing these firearms. And not only that, but they're seeking training. Training classes are filling up as fast as they're advertised. And I do have a bill out that will provide up to a $100 state income tax credit for anybody that takes a certified firearms training class. So we're trying to, I want to motivate people to get out there and learn how to safely handle and store a firearm. And, you know, these NRA certified classes, I've taken several of them, they teach that. And, you know, what to do if you have kids, this is how you should store it. These are options that are available to you. So that's one of the things I think we as legislators can do, is to encourage people to take the safe route without infringing on their rights.
Stephanie.
Yeah, I want to back up to your original question, is why do we have so many murders in this country? We know that an American is 20 times more likely to be killed with a firearm than a member of any other developed country.
And to be fair to that, we need to make a distinction that some of those numbers are not necessarily murders. They are, obviously, they are suicides.
Two-thirds are suicides.
Correct.
Yeah.
Over two-thirds of those.
Now, that is not to diminish that's a problem,
right,
too.
To address the suicide issue, America is actually in the middle of the industrialized countries when it comes to suicide, behind dozens of other countries that have incredibly strict gun laws.
Right.
But Stephanie, I want to let you finish your point.
Yeah. So we know that 88 Americans are killed every day and hundreds others are injured. And that includes 7 children being killed every day by gun violence. And the difference is that we are a country awash in guns. We have 300 million guns in this country, essentially one for every member of our United States. And we allow easy access to those guns. I mean, we don't have a lock on mental health issues in our country. But what we do is we allow people with mental health issues like depression or other issues the easy access to a gun. And that's why our rates are so much higher.
Got an email from a listener named Bree who says, I'd like to point out that while the FBI crime statistics for 2014 and 2013 do show about 435 homicides by clubs and hammers and 248 by rifles, what he intentionally neglects to mention is that handguns comprised 5,562 out of a total 11,961 in 2014. And total homicides by all firearms were 8,124 out of 11,961. This absolutely must be made clear, as your guest Bree says, is intentionally misleading listeners about deaths due to guns in this country. Representative, I'm going to give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, thank you.
Certainly.
I fail to see how I'm intentionally misleading people by reading off the FBI actual statistics right here. What she did not mention is that those deaths, the handgun deaths, are down from 6,404 in 2012 to 5,562 right now, which is showing a significant decrease. Now, again, we can all agree that every death is tragic, and we hate it, but we have to keep things in perspective and point out the fact that this is a country of 320 million people, and there are approximately 2.5 million people that die or get killed each year. Now, again, every death being tragic, but 5,500 deaths compared to, say, the 38,000 that are killed in vehicle accidents every year, or the 26,000 that are killed in accidental falls, like ladders, and situations like that. And it's estimated that 195,000 to 400,000 people die each year from medical errors. So while we want to do everything that we can within reason to diminish and decrease these deaths, again, we have to keep these in perspective.
I'm going to take a call now from a listener named Tom. Tom, welcome to the program.
Good morning. My comment is, and I agree with the one legislator, that the enforcement of existing legislation is key to at least one solution to this problem. In particular, in my experience, is the first felony charge that is plea-dealed down in cases of gun-committed crimes is the illegal use of a firearm by either a felon or an unregistered firearm. And if there was more enforcement, oh, say, such as Florida, where if you commit a violent crime with a firearm, it's an automatic so many years to your sentence. But firearm possession, like driving, is a privilege of our society. And those that are convicted felons give up certain rights in our society. And I think that the pursuit of enforcement, we have enough laws, and if those laws are enforced, then the problem will diminish.
Thanks very much for the call, Tom, and the question.
John?
Yes.
Yeah, can I come in?
Certainly, please.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to point out, the discussion between Stephanie and the representative about the level of gun deaths and how serious is it, and sort of the analogies to, you know, how does this compare to automobiles? And one important difference is we know, you know, we do all we can to minimize driver error and with education. But we also know that drivers are going to make mistakes. And what's been important with automobile safety is we've taken steps to make sure that when drivers make mistakes, the likelihood that somebody will die is reduced, whether you have seatbelts and airbags or you changed highway construction, and there are ways, okay, we know there's going to be errors. How do we minimize injuries? Or shatterproof windshields is another thing. And we're not doing that so well with gun safety that, yes, there are criminals out there and there are people who misuse guns, but how do we make sure it's harder for them to do that? So one way to do that is the Indianapolis Star points out this morning that we need to get adequate information into the data system so that background checks are reliable. Or the president talked about smart gun technology that makes it sure that only the owner, the legitimate owner of the gun can shoot it, not somebody who's stolen the gun or who has been passed on as, you know, through a straw purchase. And if we do more, there's a lot more we can do that doesn't infringe on people's rights, but make sure that when the bad guy tries to do harm or when the good person, you know, does something inadvertently, that the likelihood that harm will occur is reduced.
Representative Lucas, I mean, what is your thought on that?
I keep hearing background checks, background checks. And I'm going to keep pointing out that over 90% of the recent mass murders had passed a background check. A background check does not automatically stamp you as a good guy. And making good people helpless will not make bad people harmless. People that are intent on murdering another human being are going to do so. And I think it is immoral and horrible that we take away an innocent, lawful person's ability and right to defend themselves.
Well, if I could ask, Why is the presumption, though, that, that law-abiding people wouldn't be able to pass background checks?
They can pass them. But we keep
what's
hearing
the
that,
issue
okay,
there?
To buy a firearm right now, you go to any gun store, you have to pass a background check.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To if individual sales, which are rare, they still happen. I'll acknowledge that. But that doesn't mean that, that if that person runs and goes to a background check, that they're going to be safe. Right now, it is a felony to knowingly sell a firearm to somebody that you suspect is going to use it in a crime. That's not stopping. You know, look what happened out in California. That was a straw purchase. Didn't stop that. State with the most strict restrictive gun laws in the nation, and we still had a mass shooting event.
Stephanie.
Well, mass shootings get the nation's attention, and they get people talking about this issue, but we know that the majority of gun deaths and gun assaults don't happen in mass shootings. They happen in American homes, between family members, in domestic violence situations, in between people who know one another on the streets. It is background checks help those situations by reducing the number of guns on the streets. We know that since the background checks system was implemented, 2.5 million sales have been stopped because prohibited individuals attempted to purchase a gun. Background checks work.
Let me ask, and I want to loop back to the first email question we got from Jerry, and I don't think we explored this. You know, in the numbers that were cited, the FBI numbers, it's clear we don't really have a rifle problem. To some degree, we have a handgun problem here. And one of the things he said is, can we make distinctions between handguns and rifles? Is that reasonable? Representative Lucas. We're very tight on time, I should say, too.
Handguns are easy to carry. They're easy to use, especially females. We're seeing an explosion in women-only firearm safety classes. A handgun is the most preferred firearm that a person carries to use for self-defense. Now, also, in the same breath with that being said, they are also the most abused. So, you know, that's just one of those things that I think any laws going forward, we need to focus on the people that abuse the firearm as opposed to those that just want to use it either for recreation or self-defense purposes.
That will have to be the last word. Clearly, an hour was not nearly enough time to talk about this. I can assure our listeners, including the many, many that we whose questions we were not able to get to, this is not going to be the last time we talk about this. We will do this show again. I am John Krall. I'd like to thank my guest, Representative Jim Lucas, Stephanie Mannon Grabo, and former Representative David Orrant Licker for what has been an enlightening conversation. I'm John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzani screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.